I worshiped last week, had the privilege and unmixed pleasure of worshiping with the Roxbury Church in Boston. And the sermon, you know, even if I miss church for the next 3 weeks or so, my time balance for listening to sermons will still be in the positive category. The sermon would have made about three typically at this congregation in time. And I knew, he confirmed what I suspected, that that was not unusual, because when he'd gone about half an hour over, he said, "Well, I think I only have 5 minutes left." And by the way, he was wrong. He had lots more than 5 minutes left. But hopefully I won't try your patience this morning too much. When I was a child, among the poems that my mother read to me were poems by Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, a poet who was unfashionable even then. And there were two poems in particular that stick in my memory. One, a relatively famous poem, famous enough so that I had a student this year who, without any prompting by me, chose it as the topic for a paper in one of the courses that I teach, Values, A Psalm of Life. And A Psalm of Life is a poem of great earnestness, exhorting us to that life is real, life is earnest, and the grave is not its goal. To leave, in the famous phrase, footprints on the sands of time. And it concludes, "Let us then be up and doing with a heart for any fate, still achieving, still pursuing, learn to labor and to wait." But my mother liked better, I think, another poem by Longfellow that is far less well known, entitled "The Day Is Done." I can still remember her voice reading that poem, and I think part of the reason why it was meaningful to her is that it's a poem about reading poetry. And in it, the poet asks for someone to read poetry to him. But not the kind of poetry of which the Psalm of Life is an example. Not from the grand old masters, not from the bards sublime, whose distant footsteps echo through the corridors of time. For like strains of martial music, their mighty thoughts suggest life's endless toil and endeavor. And tonight, I long for rest. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. For what has man for all his labor and for the striving of his heart with which he has toiled under the sun? For all his days are sorrowful and his work burdensome. Even in the night, his heart takes no rest. There is a view of religion that says that religion is about rest. That we come to a place like this as a refuge, and we come not to be disturbed, but to be quieted. And there is a great deal of truth in that, because religion, true religion, offers rest from foolish labor. Why do people spend money for that which is not bread? And for their labor, for that which does not satisfy. Isaiah said 27 centuries ago. And in Matthew, Jesus lays down this principle that we're not to be anxious for those things that we cannot affect. And that matter very little anyway. And God knows what we need, and He'll provide for us. And so one of the things that religion does is keep us from useless labor and useless worry. And it would be tragic, right, for us to have just enough religion for that religion to make us miserable. For us to view religion as something whose purpose it is to remind us to be unhappy. There are reasons enough, and we do not need reminder. It is through by being anxious and nothing that God can create for us a peace that passes understanding, as Paul writes the Philippians. And it may be sometimes in our lives that just getting through life without giving up, without despair, with dignity and compassion, both for ourselves and others, is the highest and best thing that we can do. There are moments in our lives of loss when it is against the shock of that loss that we must simply endure. This last week, I went up to Boston to run in the marathon. Of course, I never ran a step. Got violently ill the night before. I've been ill in the week since. And I know, right, there are times when any thought of making progress was foolish for me. I schemed all morning to somehow get to the start line and managed not to do it, which was good. I'd run 1,034 miles to prepare and then not one in the race. But to endure is a good thing, but let endurance have her perfect work. Was this last Monday a day in which I could stop preparing, having not been unable to run in the race? Was it a day I could stop preparing for heaven? A day in which it was okay for me to do nothing? Or might it be that in those times when we feel most incapable of action, that the most important action of changing our character into the character of Christ is most incumbent upon us? The religion of Jesus is rest from labor, but it's also a call to labor. It says to those who are weary and heavy laden, come and I'll give you rest. But it also says to them, take my yoke upon you and learn of me, And in the passage from John 9, which was read for you this morning, actually the most probable reading of John 9:4 does not begin that it is necessary for me to work the works of the one who sent me, but it is necessary for us, it's in the plural, to work the works of those of the one who sent me. Jesus includes us by command as well as by his example in this duty to accomplish in our lives what God has set before us. We're to have rest from foolish labor, but not rest from labor. If you might turn in your Bibles to 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 9 through 12. Paul writes, "But concerning brotherly love, you don't have any need for me to write to you, for you yourselves are taught of God to love each other. For you also do this very thing to all the brethren throughout Macedonia. But we exhort you, brethren, to excel all the more and to make it your ambition to be at peace and to mind your own business," which could also be translated to do your duty, your tasks, "and to work with your hands, even as we commanded you, in order that you may conduct yourselves honorably to those who are without and have need of nothing." And if you think about the words that Paul wrote, let me just point out three ideas that are present there. One, he talks about labor as love. At the very beginning of his letter, he will use the famous phrase, "I know that your work of faith, your labor of love, your endurance of hope." And again, in our culture and sometimes in the church, we talk as though work were something that was the alternative to love. No, it isn't. It's the expression of love. It's the evidence of love. And it's that which helps us to create in ourselves love. And point number two, he has as the ambition for the people at Thessalonica who were troubled by various things, by persecution, by their concern about the end of the world. And he said, make it your ambition to be at peace. And he uses a phrase that's more than just be at peace, but to make peace. To be at peace yourselves and to be the source of peace in the lives of other people. And point number three, that is achieved in part by labor. I don't think that any of us are built are designed by God in such fashion that we can be at peace without purpose, without achieving something, without our life meaning something. Paul recognizes that and he encourages the people to whom he is writing to find peace by labor. What is that labor? I heard many sermons when I was a boy about the work of the church. And I think that the things that are said in such sermons are the right thing to say when we're talking about the work of each of us as an individual, because the church does not have existence apart from the individual members. As a lawyer, I know this whole, I was a corporation lawyer, which is another way of saying I was a fictional lawyer. I was a fictional lawyer in a number of different ways. But, hey, I understand that corporations are fictional people. We pretend like they are people, but they don't actually do anything. Only the people who act in corporations are moral agents. Only the people in a church are the moral agents in that church. And so when I talk about the work of the church and I make use of the famous summary that the work of the church is benevolence and edification and evangelism, what I'm really saying is that that's my work and yours. The work of the church is benevolence. Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Fathers is this, to visit the orphans and the widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. It is part of religion to be negative about things that are wrong. But none of us is entitled to define ourselves by what we are not. I don't just not want Satan living in me. I want Christ actually living in me. And for me to do that, I need to do good to all men, especially to those who are of the household of faith. And I want to do good in tangible ways, right? In part so that other people can see that I mean it when I say that I love them. And in part to make sure that I mean it. Because if my religion is just talk, if when I take it into any arena that involves actual sacrifice, it does not affect my actions, then I cannot possibly be truly a follower of Christ. To take what Paul says, if I can't love other people in something as simple as just material prosperity, if I can't share that with them, how could I possibly share those things that are most meaningful, most important to me? And edification. In 1 Thessalonians, again, in chapter 5, Paul talks about building one another up. And that building one another up, that creating strength in other people, helping them find who they are, helping them feel the stability of being connected to us and to God, is inevitably connected to building ourselves up. Who is an encourager to me? I was talking to my wife about someone who had done something that if somebody else had done, I would be irritated by it. Right? That happens occasionally to you. I don't know. I find it all too easy. Right? For me to respond in irritation to something. And I say, Neil, I would have been irritated, except that it's impossible for me to be irritated with that person. I just love them too much. They've meant too much to me. And some of you have encouraged me in various ways for which I'm constantly grateful. But the larger answer is that every single person who lives life honorably and lovingly and wisely, every single person who belongs to God encourages me. Because they make me hope. that I can belong to him. That this task of being like Christ is something that can be done. And in the same way, every single person, whether there is any malice present or not, every single person who fails discourages me. And what is true for me is true for you. I know it is. And so this idea that I can build other people up without myself, allowing God's work of redeeming my character, of freeing me not just from guilt, but from sin, from evil, would be foolish. The two must go together. And evangelism, which of course it follows from the other, because if I love other people, what do I want to do? I want to do what's best for them. I don't just want what's good. I want what's best. And what's best, what every person needs the most, is to be at peace with God. So this whole idea that I could care about people, that I could give my money and really mean it as an act of love and believe in the gospel and not share it, that's craziness. That can't be. An unevangelistic Christian is a Christian who either doesn't care about other people or doesn't understand. Isn't truly convinced of both the willingness of other people, the openness of other people to the gospel, and the power of the gospel. That God can save sinners. And of course, these three things are all tied together. Right? Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. It obviously ties to the passage that was read from John 9. Jesus is the light of the world, and so we must be the light of the world. And we must live our lives, as Peter says, to show forth the excellences of the one who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. Now, in the actual accomplishment of that work, just a thought or two. How are we to go about that work? And the one basic insight I would offer is that to accomplish that work, I mean, it will take great effort. Strive to enter in at the narrow gate. Because many will seek to enter in and shall not be able. That I have said over and over to my students, I'm sure there are students present here who've heard me say in class, when I teach in values or in one of my Bible courses, and one of the threshold problems that I occasionally have with students is they think, oh yeah, I know all this, right? If I was in chemistry, I'd expect to have to work. But I got this business about being like Jesus of Nazareth. What a snap. How easy. No, it's not. All of human experience teaches us that it's not. It wasn't easy for him. And it's not going to be easy for us. But the basic insight I would offer about how to go about that is that, hey, what's true about worldly labor is going to be true about spiritual labor. right? That's why there are parables. That's why the parables work. Right? Jesus says spiritual life is like the way the natural world works. And so things like cause and effect are true spiritually. Nothing happens automatically. You know, that word automatic means self-causing. And there's a word in the Greek New Testament that's properly translated automatic. And there's a sense in which, hey, I understand that that's a proper word, but there's also a sense in which the word automatic is always a lie. Because nothing happens because of itself. And if I want to be different tomorrow than I am today, if I want other people to be different tomorrow than they are today, I must do something today to cause that to happen. And in the same way, not only is work necessary, but work over time, right? Think about the agricultural parables of Jesus and this lesson that you sow the seed and then you do more than just sow. You continually work. In due season, you will reap if you don't faint. The final point that I would make, again, along the same lines, is to tie it back to where we started. If we're to accept this task of every day making ourselves better, helping other people to become better, then we must go about it in ways that aren't self-defeating. We must not take upon ourselves burdens that we cannot bear or ask of ourselves a wisdom of which we are incapable. And so I don't need to decide every theological question. I don't need to decide the eternal fate of people whom I have never met. I don't need to know how I would respond or how other people should respond to situations none of us are facing. I need to concentrate on the task that is set before me and to let foolish and unlearned questions alone. And I need to understand the limits of what I can do. It's one of the hardest lessons to learn in life for any of us who've truly cared about other people, that we cannot live their lives for them. And that we're going to fail, especially if we reach out to people who are most in trouble. I was talking to one of you this past week. And we're talking about the fact that, hey, if I was a doctor, if I was a lawyer, and I've often heard people say this in law firms. There was a person, the head of our litigation section, law firm. He was a man almost my age now, and they said he'd never lost a case. Well, I can make certain that I never lose a case. Just don't take any case except a winner. I can be a doctor who never loses a patient. All I need to do is restrict my practice to healthy people. But if I reach out to the people who are most in trouble, sometimes I'm going to fail. Sometimes they're going to be lost. And I need to learn to leave to God in His grace both judgment of the other person and judgment of myself. In the Psalm of Life, Longfellow says, "Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end or way, but to act that each tomorrow find us farther than today." I invite you to make this day, both at this moment and as the day goes on, a day in which you end the day closer to your God, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually, than you are at this moment. If you're apart from Him in a way that needs a public response and need to be baptized for the remission of your sins, or you need to come back confessing fault and be reunited in the fellowship of the church, or if you in some other way you ask, you need and wish to ask for the prayers of this congregation, we encourage you to come as we stand and sing.